Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of Wonderstruck. I'm your host, Elizabeth Revere. I'm a clinical psychologist, a yoga teacher, and a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. I'm really curious about our experiences of wonder and awe and how they transform us. My guest today is Mike Murphy, co-founder of Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Esalen is remarkable in a number of ways, from the breathtaking land it inhabits to the ongoing beauty and rigor of its mission. Since opening in 1962, Esalen has served as an incubator for human potential. Guests come from all over the world to engage openly and meaningfully in their own transformation. Having visited last year, I started to wonder about Esalen's origins, its guiding vision, and how the Institute and its co-founder came of age together during a time of great spiritual awakening in the United States. Now, 93, Mike Murphy recalls his own evolution and Esalen's with a detailed clarity that feels cinematic. His grandfather first arrived on the land by horseback. An armed Hunter S. Thompson worked the grounds as a security guard. Mike himself, a student of the religion scholar Frederick Spiegelberg, and a yogi trained at Sri Aurobindo's ashram in India, had a showdown with a drug dealer named Big Bad Bill, and later fought hard to keep cults out of Esalen. In a conversation that spans the better part of a century, Mike talks about living a life out ahead of the game and tapping into a greater consciousness that serves both the self and the world. That's actually something he said about Taylor Swift, but it also applies to how he's lived his life as an innovator, a visionary, and a true believer in helping others access the tools that will change their lives. Welcome back to Wonderstruck. I am speaking to Mike Murphy, the founder of Esalen, a best-selling author, a visionary, and so I've heard, a great Celtic storyteller. So maybe, I mean, just most people do know about Esalen to a certain extent, and some people don't know as much about it. And essentially, we know that it's a holistic center looking at human potential, that you all look, take science, the fine arts, the humanities, metaphysics, spirituality, and look at it from a holistic perspective, which is just fantastic. And I think it's even in your mission statement that says that you have the curiosity and the daring to look at questions that often academia and seminary, religious studies places don't look at. Just also the fact of walking into Esalen and the beautiful land and the scenery and the landscape is almost, it actually is kind of a transcendent experience. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about Esalen and the land and the baths.
Well, okay, very briefly, it's Esalen. The reason we've been able to do what you just described, to be unbound by academia or business or government or whatever, is that when I had the dream for the place originally, and I had grown up on that land, not as our kind of getaway place, but my grandfather had bought this land 2 miles of Big Sur coast in 1910. And there was no highway open through that coast, that Highway 1, until 1937. And wow. It didn't get to that property until 35. They had to, the early people in my family and all had to come in on horseback. It's a kind of a wild west, the last shred. And in fact, when we did get underway in 1961 and 62, we turned to the sheriff for help because there were a lot of people camped there who didn't believe in private property. And these were, to describe these characters, that in itself would take an hour here, but the sheriff refused to send his men. He says, "You boys have guns?" He was from the South. And we said, "No, we don't have guns." Although the previous caretaker, who had been Hunter S. Thompson, hired him. He was just 21 years old. And wow. He hadn't published any books yet. He was trying to be right. But in any case, we had that. But we said to the sheriff, We don't, he said, well, you boys, he was a Southern guy, you boys, you get yourself some guns because I'm not sending my men down to your bad land. Bad land. Wow. Well, anyway, so we, you know, this was a blessing and a difficulty. So we were born to the freedom to do what we want. We have succeeded. The property really is part of the blessing. Well, it's the basis of the blessing we have there, because it has a very evocative power over people, which it still is much discussed how it works. And one reason is, you know, being right there on the property rolls along from 40 to 100 feet above the ocean, right on the cliff. So you're always, there's the ocean, but there are these high hills, you could say small mountains behind you going up to 1500 feet. So it's on, you're on the front edge of a sled that's actually moving. You know, it actually is, the tectonic plates are shifting. And we have this volcanically produced water that comes out of these cliffs. And that was why my grandfather bought the property, for those that hot springs. He wanted to create a spa. He was a doctor. He had a couple of hospitals. He had originally come out from Tennessee in the early 1890s and ended up in Salinas. And so he wanted to build a spa down on the coast. And those hot baths are there, and they are a pervasive influence. And plus those waves breaking in on some of the big ones, come in 20 feet tall, it will bang against those cliffs.
Wow.
And you can actually sit in these hot tubs, and in a stormy day when it's going, and you're safe in a hot tub that is anchored into the cliff, and these waves come rolling in, so you're raw and exposed to the elements. And so there's a lot of theory, you know, negative ions, for example, but people get high on the land.
Yeah.
And so that helps. And, you know, well-known teachers who come and leading different workshops compare the experience there to, say, doing it in a Hyatt house or doing it somewhere in a hotel. It just is completely different. And it also has different microclimates. So one part of, we'd have to spend the rest of the hour describing this, but temperatures and so forth. So I like to say there are also different psychic microclimates, different moods that result from these workshops.
Yeah.
And people's range of emotion and range of conversation is, for most people, richer anywhere else. But we've managed, and I think we've gotten a lot better of it through the years, in a sense, inviting safe emergencies.
Yeah.
People to explore into this or that in an edgy way. You just couldn't get away with it in a classroom at Harvard or Stanford. I mean, you couldn't do it. Or in a hotel or in a church. So it has that freedom, but yet I think we've really learned how to keep it basically safe.
Yeah.
In the 60s, it wasn't altogether safe. And we were lucky that I had to consult with the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, in 64. We started in 62. But in 64, I met with the head of the DEA for Northern California. He's actually a great guy. And he lectured me on the Fourth Amendment. And he said, now look, you cannot go into people's rooms searching them for whether they've got anything on them, because they can sue you out of existence. You leave that to us. But what you have to do is get rid of the dealers. And yes, we do have our men occasionally patrolling.
Yeah.
So I had to confront the famous dealer down there Big Bad Bill. And it was when I won my spurs as the young innkeeper, when I had to tell Big Bad Bill he could never come back again. And it was a kind of a showdown out of High Noon. He was 6 foot 4, cut and buffed, wore a big black hat, and he was about as alpha male can get. So word got out that I was going to confront, that little Mikey Murphy was going to confront Big Bad Bill. So, oh my God, my so-called friends gathered around to watch this thing. And
Oh
so,
my.
yeah, right in this lodge
You had a showdown.
we had a showdown in front of 30, my good buddies watching with vast amusement and wonderment. And anyway, he came in and I told him, I said, Bill, all is well, it's all good. Nobody's going to get in trouble, but I do have to tell you right now, the DEA is on to us and on to you. I told a lie. I said, one of them is watching us now, but I have to just tell you, Bill, you can never come on this property again. Well, he tried to control himself, but I could just feel him, the nostrils dilating. He looked like him like this. And he had a little crisis, but sitting still and looking at me, this imposing character. Then he relaxed, reached out, and said, "Thank you, Mike. Thank you."
Well done.
And he got up, and we walked out, and I was promoted in the eyes of the onlookers.
Yeah, very, very good success in conflict resolution, handling that super smoothly. That's it. You make a point though, Mike, about how Esalen, also it's like the land is transcendent. Being there is a profound experience, and that you just don't need, I mean, psychedelics can be a great pathway to something, but it's only one pathway. There's so much more, and so much more of what you all do there involves, other types of research and experiences beyond the psychedelics. And it makes me come back to the original question I wanted to ask you, is that you ended up, even in, from what I understand, you ended up by accident in Frederick Spiegelberg's class at Stanford instead of your pre-med class. Like, you were moving into the science, and by accident or serendipity, you end up in this religion, comparative religion class by a guy, he was taught by Carl Jung, right?
He was good friends with Jung at the Aronhaus meetings in Europe, and
Right.
but he was a very close friend of Paul Tillich's.
Right.
And when Hitler came to power in 33, fortunately, a few were out of the property that were targeted for immediate control. Einstein, Tillich, a few others. So Frederick had to take over Tillich's teaching role in Dresden, and luckily he got out, and he waited too long. But anyway, in 37 he got out and came to America. So anyway, he brought this rich European culture, and he had a great presence, I was lucky. And yes, it was by mistake. I was 19. I was a sophomore, and pre-med and so forth. And I'd heard about it. And this was the second lecture. I said, "Well, I'm going to stay here just for this lecture." And he came out and immediately quieted these restless Stanford kids, 600 of them, because it was an auditorium. That's the reason they shifted classes. And this was one of these big lecture things that he was coming in, and they came in and stood in front up on a on the stage and waited for silence, which came right away. And then he just said one word, Brahman, one word. And then he lectured on the Vedic hymns and the early Upanishads. And at the end of this lecture, in which he held us spellbound, I had been a religious kid, but in the first wave of the Stanford stuff, I'd kind of abandoned forever the Virgin Mary and the Trinity. And I'd been an altar boy in the Episcopal Church, a religious kid, but I had abandoned the Christian apparatus. But I heard that, and then at the end of the lecture, he said one other word, Atman, which is Brahman. Well, I had to go back up to my fraternity, walking out of there, and just one sentence kept going through my head like an obsessional thought: "You'll never be the same. You'll never be the same." I was in a, it was really, Elizabeth, really an exaltation. So I quit my course and stayed in this thing for the spring semester of my second year there. And to make a long story short, that led to me dropping my pre-med. I thought I was going to be a doctor, and it was kind of a role assignment from the family, basically. And quit the fraternity and shocked my family, who, thought, as my father said to me, "Son, if you could have shifted to anything else except a yogi, what does a yogi do?"
Did your dad finally think, like, oh, wow, look what you've done with Esalen, and look at this, a human potential movement that you've created and influenced the world in this way? Did they finally get it, or?
They got it even before that. I have to tell you, oh God, my parents were incredible. My father at first threatened to sue Stanford for ruining their son, destroying their son. But after I graduated and I was on fire, I was lit up at that point. I was a certified religious nut at this point. I was meditating 6 or 8 hours a day. I was on fire. But in any case, I was had to be in the army, and so I was in the Korean War. And a big check came in the mail. I was stationed for heroic duty in Puerto Rico in the Great War of the Mosquitoes down there. But in comes this check, and it says, "Mike, this is, if you decide to go to India, this will get you there." And he and my parents are fantastic.
That's wonderful that they kind of turned around. I mean, it was kind of dramatic. And I'm thinking about for you, like as you describe it, that exaltation. Like you go into that class and it's, Brahman and then Atman, and you walk out changed,
Right.
And then you're going to India at some point, and then you're founding Esalen. And I think about that again, going back to the psychedelics. From when I was reading Jeff Preipal's book, The History of Esalen, I understand that, in your life you've had a psychedelic experience or tried it only 6 or 7 times. And so that's not that many, relatively speaking. And so I was just curious if you would maybe tell us why so little, or maybe that seems like a lot, I don't know. And then I also understand that Aldous Huxley and his wife Laura guided you in, I
Right.
guess, your first or second experience. So it's like, I just wonder if there's something fascinating to hear about that.
Well, these are great questions for me. Well, when I lit up as a 19-year-old, and it came even in that first course in the spring of 1950. With an introduction to a wide range of metaphysical framings by Spiegelberg, who was steeped in this, and he knew. I learned about Sri Aurobindo, the Indian philosopher, whose mystical vision was based on the idea, it's an ancient idea, that the entire cosmos is emanated from the divine and into what he called the inconscient, into matter, and in the course of time is manifesting its implicit divinity. That's the basis of yearning we secretly all have to go further with our lives. And that yearning gets refracted through this immense prism of the evolutionary process itself, and then through the culture we inhabit, and through our schooling, and through our family. And it's always pressing to be born in us. And so the task of the Aurobindo Yoga was to broker that and bring it into existence. That's the guiding idea for me. To start Esalen. Yeah. That's why I wanted to do it. And then to find all these companions, comrades, pressing in the same direction. So we became a rallying place. This is in the early 60s.
Yeah.
At first, it was basically lecture programs for a couple of years. But we had quite an all-star cast. And when we started, we had a kind of vertical takeoff. Half the leaders were famous.
Yeah.
So, we have never lacked for people wanting to be at Esalen. And it's not that big a place. I mean, now we've reduced the number of people on the property because it got to be like Coney Island. I mean, it pretty soon you had, oh my God, people were all over the place, and we had to get it under control, learn how to manage it, bring it to where it is today. Mm-hmm. Better managed than ever now. We've gotten more professional, but we've remained open and free, and nobody's captured the flag. This is what we said.
Yeah. Well, wait, but explain what you mean by nobody's captured the flag, because that's a great philosophy.
This was when Dick Price and I made common cause. My grandmother at first said, we can never give this property to Michael because he will immediately Hindus. Immediately. When I came to her in 1958 or 59, I was 27, 28 by then in Bindi, India, living in India. And but then through, there's been a lot written about this, and Jeff Kripal's book describes it. Well, we had a kind of breech birth, you know, with gunfire and everything, and Hunter Thompson. He helped give birth to this whole thing through the trouble. He was, oh God, what a thing. So that came with a lot of excitement and more psychedelics than we realize.
But now, you mean that nobody captures the flag? Is that like?
I had been vaccinated against cult before this started. First, while I was at Stanford, a group of us students formed in my junior and senior years, and it around a very charismatic graduate student. And you know, when you're raw to the world in a university like that, there are more than a few charismatic graduate students forming circles.
Mm.
I don't care what university it's at. Nobody's written yet a great history of this. But all right, so that was, fortunately, I ducked out of that. It became a cult. I mean, there were originally about 9 in it, then it got down to 4 or 5. So that was a mini cult. But then later, a few years later, when I went to live in India at the ashram of Sri Aurobindo, a really elite group of people who were in the sadhana, about 1,500, with servants who, you know, you would be meditating and a servant would be cleaning your room while you meditated. So it was an upper class cult. And it under this, the flag, Aurobindo had died, and his great co-worker, the mother, Mira Alfassa, she was from Europe, French, Jewish, came up, well, a very compelling person. And the life there was fantastic. But the dogmas were reinforced, and everybody recited Aurobindo by memory. And it was like the Episcopal Church all over again for me. And when I would deviate in any way, I could feel it. And then that really alerted me to this tendency of mystical practice or any kind of religious aspiration constellate a group of companions who solidify, and it's kind of like a super saturated solution. You tap it on the jar when, and softly in high school chemistry, and then it crystallizes. The crystallization of attitude, of ethic, of, and then you can tell how people stand. There's a way to stand. I love these anthropologists who study, Pierre Bourdieu, who, how French working class men will not eat fish because their feet, to put it on your lips and chew like that. A man shouldn't. A man eats beef and not a fish. And okay, so we pick up 1,000 habits, and it just calls this happens. That shapes consciousness because mind and body mirror each other all the time. Okay, Dick had his own vaccination against cults. So when we started that, little did I know that how relentless some of the teachers that we had would try to enforce their whole system. Fritz Perls, who invented Gestalt therapy, he really wanted, as he said, I've always had this dream of having a big Jewish kibbutz, the Gestalt kibbutz in Israel. And he, all right, and he was very intent of weaning me away from what he called the mystical and the occult.
Oh, interesting.
Oh yeah, and he would send his minions around and et cetera. So Dick and I had to work at it. It's not enough to say we want an open system. You have to watch how this, the Rajneeshis, for example, started to come to Esalen. Pretty soon it was a real attempt to take. So we have succeeded, but it's you have to be vigilant. So anyway, that idea, just finishing back to psychedelics, you asked me about that. But in the in those years between that class at Stanford, I was 20, and starting Esalen, I was 30. In those 10 years, I had really based my daily practice in meditation. Meditation can come in different with different varieties and so forth. So I say, speaking broadly, I was into it, and it lit me up, and it came to me naturally. It did. I'd been a religious kid in high school, an altar boy for the Episcopal Church, but now it was meditation, but et cetera. But I was all right. Now came psychedelics, and in the first year of our programs, I'd had one session with peyote buttons alone, which hit me sideways and whoa, experiences I had never had with meditation. But then the second one was with Aldous Huxley and Laura Huxley. So Laura sat with me for 6, 7 hours, and Aldous, at this point, this is 1962, got his psychedelics right from Sandoz, and he had written The Doors of Perception. He had influenced the language I used in the early brochures, because if I had quoted Aurobindo too much, or Hegel, or Fichte, or, I mean, nobody would have come. I mean, for that beautiful English that he wrote. And so he had been an influence. And that trip was interesting. Okay, and then I had six more. I had eight trips between then and 66. I have to say, Elizabeth, really, each one was worse than the preceding.
Fascinating, huh?
Got worse. And I could tell it's not my ally. This is not
Yeah.
my ally. And so I quit in
Okay.
66. So as it was cresting at Esalen, I was shrinking from it. We were going opposite directions. So finally, at Esalen, along with the culture generally, it regurgitated this. It's we overdosed. It was a drunken mysticism.
Yeah. We're very capable of getting drunk on almost anything, right?
Amen. Amen. And that's Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, William Blake. I mean, we
Yeah.
as has gone through different stages, and it still is. And the demographic, Esalen's demographic, which exists worldwide, has not yet, I believe, been adequately described by any sociologist, cultural anthropologist, or historian. It's a river. It's like an atmospheric river flowing in the sky. Well, this is a cultural river flowing through the world towards this secret, to this greater life that's pressing to be born in us.
Everything that you're touching upon follows kind of the trajectory of what I want to ask you about, starting from the physical body into the greater consciousness, and everything in between, and to a certain extent. And, I just, it's all there. And what I mean by that is just starting with people probably, or well, some people probably do not know that you wrote the definitive book on golf in 1971. People that play golf know this book. And it seems kind of, when I first heard about it, I was like, wait, what? And then I read, it's like you talk about how the soul, the actual soul, is reflected in the golf swing. And I was like, that's fascinating. That's like yoga. And then it goes into the whole subtle body aspect with the theosophist doing like these exercises to activate consciousness and the soul. And anyway, so you got to start there, right?
Elizabeth, thank you for bringing it up. I mean, yeah, that's the first book I ever wrote. And it's the luckiest thing I've ever done. I had no idea that it would trigger what it says, 52 years. It's in nine languages. If I go out to a golf course and the word gets out that I'm there, someone is going to come in and confess their latest mystical experience on a golf course.
It's amazing. Okay, you got to tell us one of them. Give us a good golf mystical experience.
The experiences range widely. And now, and lately, more and more, first of all, there's a range of experience that is very gentle and unobtrusive, that is not as dramatic as some of these experiences people will tell me it's right out of James's Varieties of Religious Experience. But this is a more subtle thing that happens. And it's come up for me big time now in our study of subtle bodies. And that is a kind of natural high that golfers experience. Now, even though they get into these great lamentations that they miss this golf shot, and it's fiendishly clever game, and it's profoundly absurd. Whacking a little ball into a little hole a quarter of a mile away, and then doing this 18 times. It takes 4 hours, let's say, for an average round. All right. But they come away lamenting their bad shot or bragging about this miracle shot or whatever. But with it all, a pervasive sense of well-being. I mean, people have it. Now, I equate it, if somebody wants to correlate it with psychedelics, to a very gentle, very light dose of psilocybin, where you're not having visions, you're not having ecstasies, but you're kind of in a glow. Yeah, it's the easy glow. Now, my friend Richard Baker, who's truly a creative Zen teacher, he says a lot of this elementary meditation is happening all the time, to countless people lying on beaches in the sun and just letting go to feeling good sunbathing. And
Yeah.
what might start to happen in a meditation retreat or a golf. And anyway, it sets the stage for deeper and more dramatic disclosures. When you play golf, you necessarily have a certain amount of sensory deprivation by this continual refocusing on this absurd act and complex swing. I mean, we in the Paleolithic, our Paleolithic ancestors in the hunt did not do a golf swing. If they were charged by a bear, I mean, you don't have time to tee up a ball and hit it. And so it's an acquired athletic capability and fiendishly challenging. I must say, this is why when you see a Tiger Woods hit a ball and you see it fly for 300 yards, it's unbelievable. It's if you're near it, it's awesome. Wonderstruck, you know, it's
Yeah, that's great.
natural. And your tendency to think it's a speciation difference. When you're around these pro athletes, they do things that the rest of us can't do. It's awesome.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. Okay, so back to these what people are telling me. So I'm thinking, you know, along with it is coming these experiences. And so anyway, anybody who's done any kind of sensory deprivation stuff, say in a flotation tank or whatever, it allows your unconscious material to come up. So it's not unlike, it's the same, it's affiliated to, let's say, a psychoanalysis on the couch, a Freudian psychoanalysis, and free association, and then a natural catharsis and whatever. And psychology generally has learned this, and we've dramatically explored it over those since Freud so forth. Again, you're focusing in on some setup that focuses you in a way to allow this disclosure to occur in you. All right, but there are different layers of human nature. So not only do you see, people see we people, and not only get this preliminary glow, but we'll have will be taken out beyond themselves. A woman told me once that on a summer afternoon, as the sun was setting, and she was playing the 18th hole of her country club, she suddenly was caught in a state in which she could see the sun rising through the ground. Now, this is her language. The sun was rising through the ground, and I realized the sun was setting. This is one of these gorgeous California magnificent golf courses, and you can see the sun setting, but it was rising through the ground. And then she went into the clubhouse, and it was shining through the walls. And it shone through the walls of her car as she drove home. And she woke up the next morning, and it was shining into her bedroom. And she experienced something she had never experienced in her entire life. And it changed her life. So when I they published the 50-year anniversary of the book, so they wanted there at the publisher wanted to have a new foreword or something. So I then told him, I described this story in that foreword to the latest rendition of Golf in the Kingdom, because at what one point, and when I saw her again, she asked me, "Is this what they mean? Is this what Mark Zuckerberg means by the metaverse?" And I thought, and she said, "What do you think? What would Shiva's Iron say, the protagonist?"
Oh, right,
So,
in your book.
well, Shiva's Iron. So I imagined this, and it was this publisher, a lovely guy. He said, "Listen, nail that one because it's up for people now. What's the role of technology and the metaverse and the internet and now AI and et cetera?" So anyway, I described what he would say. You know, it's an absurdity. And of course, this is a lady who had never studied William James or Plotinus or Meister Eckhart or the great mystics of antiquity. But her description was that of the highest order of realization. There are a lot of words in Sanskrit for this. When Spiegelberg conveyed hints of this when he stood up on that when I was a kid and said Brahman, which is Atman, our deepest subjectivity. We are secretly that. Okay, so she was untutored metaphysically. So all these golfers, totally untutored, they've never been in a comparative study, a religion course. It's the mysticism of everyday life, which is abroad in the culture. It's everywhere, and but it's not named. We live, we fly under strange flags. So it has converged with, all the Esalen aspiration, and to say that this is abroad, this is us. We are wired for this. But all,
It makes me think of how many people, because that book is such a success and a bestseller, how many people that book on golf has reached that would not be reading William James or Plotinus or any of these kinds of mystical things. Like you said, with this woman who saw this glow, this incredibly life-changing experience.
yes.
So what a gift to her and to others that have a book on golf that's like anchoring it into
Yeah.
something that we don't talk about.
Right. Elizabeth, that's well said. I appreciate that a lot. I mean, exactly. I mean, did you ever read John Carse?
I did not.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, he has, oh God, he was wonderful. He was into this. And there's a book, Victory at the Breakfast at the Victory. The Victory was the name of a little stand. It's somewhere in Manhattan, maybe Brooklyn. It's the mysticism of everyday life. It breaks out in ways that, well, anyway, that's a lot of people don't really get from their religious, from Sunday school. I mean, they. And that's where why the people at Esalen are a lot of them. It's kind of like part of a cosmic jailbreak. I mean, breaking out of the strictures to come to this magnificent, or in a way where we're all having to be brought out of the closet,
Yes,
that metaphor,
absolutely.
our mystic closet.
You know, this makes me think of our common friend Simon Cox, who he was telling me a story that you had shared with him about the weirdness bell curve. This idea that, as you were saying, right, this is a human capacity. We are ourselves and we're beyond ourselves. And most of the time we don't know it because you don't get it in Sunday school. And that people have this capacity to get it on a certain level. We get it, we get it, we get it. Then we hit here and it gets way too weird. And it's like, okay, shutting the door on the closet, no more. But that's
Right.
why, like what you've done with Esalen is opening this door. And the book on golf and the future body and the study of the subtle body. It's fantastic. Mike, what do you think this opening of the door, it goes back to doors of perception, but opening the door to this can do for us as humanity, as a globe, as a world civilization, as with all the divisiveness and everything else, like, how do you see the future aided by this?
All right, you've got the right question. How? Fritz Perls, God bless him. I mean, he did he could be a bully, but he had a clinical genius. I mean, to look at people, and he wasn't always nice on how he informed those people about such and such they were doing, and they weren't ready for it. But anyway, he agreed with the Buddha, who would not do metaphysics. And all the Buddha was interested in is how. How do we achieve this nirvana, or whatever you want to, however you want to frame it? We have to find ways to work our way out of these political jams, et cetera, et cetera. This is the game of all games. It's the cosmic game. How to grow into this greater life that's within us, we glimpse, and some people pursue. Obviously, they come to Esalen. They're pursuing it, and how? So if that's we don't have much time left here today, but there are lots of different hows, and there now that's been a great change, and this is part of this change in the demographic, which I don't think has been fully embraced yet by mainstream sociology and cultural anthropology. The invention rate has gone way up for the ways and means of practice. And it's not been, now the Gallup poll and other polls have been right to say that more and more people will say that they're spiritual but not religious. So that's something. It gives a headline. There are many studies that I would say have made a preliminary advance into seeing it in the culture. But okay, so believe me, no football teams that I ever heard of won a national championship with their quarterback, particularly Michigan, which has won more games than any other college. It's interesting. And I hadn't known that. Now it's all broadcast because of their national championship. But to have the quarterback, kind of when I went to high school, boy, the girls flocked to the quarterback first. They tend to be good looking and tall and glamorous in high schools across America, and then they get to college. Oh my God, the quarterback, and becoming a yogi, and me to be a yogi. I was a kind of a star in school, for, and so my
Were you
father,
a quarterback?
no, I'm not a football star. I was a good athlete, but well, anyway, but I wasn't. It wouldn't have been big enough, and also the quarterbacks just were bigger and better looking, and the girls, I'm just trailing after them. And I'm embellishing this a little, but for that guy to be demonstrating this yoga position in the out on the edge of the field before the game with his shoes off, I mean, it was a what was he's trying to tell us something. He's standing. Or this. Well, all I'm saying is this stuff is spreading in these strange ways. And I predict that some great books are going to appear that dramatize this emergent something.
Because I really did want to ask you. I know that Esalen had this, that you've got the Future of the Body book, in which when I was reading it, you talk about you study extraordinary experiences, kind of near-death experiences, astral body and astral travel and all these things. And you said in your book, you ask yourself, like, what does this mean? Does this change my belief in God or something beyond? And you said in 1992, you were agnostic. So I wanted to know, since then, and since you had the CIRSEMs at Esalen, what's changed for you, if it has? Are you still agnostic?
Now, when I said agnostic, that I was agnostic about what's going on, first with reincarnation and with survival. I am not agnostic about Brahman and Atman and Brahman.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. That helps. Of course.
I wanted Esalen to be part of the embrace of this implicit divinity on the one hand, but not locked into the dogmas that have associated the religion, where I don't want to relitigate that which we know. Know that this greater consciousness is available. And why relitigate it again and again and again? And for me, you don't need to relitigate telepathy, clairvoyance. Now, a lot of these psychic powers to me are facts. So I want to help midwife the cutting edge of as yet not fully understood demographic. There are a lot of people around like you and me who enough already. Oh God, if we have to do one more experiment with telepathy, I want to puke. I mean, we've done a 10,000 already. I mean, it's a fact. It's not repeatable like this or that, but how much that all of us who are just common sense, sensible people know that's unrepeatable, but we know as a fact.
I feel like people would be very interested in what your daily practice is because, can I say what your age is?
93.
Yeah. So the question is, why do you look 39 instead of 93? Or you still look like the high school quarterback. I mean, like, what are you doing?
Well, listen,
What's going on over there?
you've made my day with that 39 number. See, I'll take whatever number I can get. I've never gotten a 39 before, but well, I don't know. I mean, in terms of a lot of it, seriously, Elizabeth, is that is genes. You know, I have there are a lot of long-lived folks, and I say I have enough good habits. Many. You got to be careful. Not too many, because I do have friends who their good habits shorten their life. And but it's all right. There's been a lot of experimentation, you know, with everything. But you know, for example, no matter what you ask me, I mean, what I eat, I do have, I have found my way to what works for me on
Well,
eating.
do you ha what's your routine like? I mean, do you wake up and meditate? Do you take long walks?
Okay.
Broccoli?
It's in my 20s. And I was a certified nutcase. I mean, I was sitting 6 to 8 hours a day. And I did that, and even in the army, you know, in the army, well, I maybe I worked half an hour a day. If you ever wrote the, you know, that great book, what's, oh God, about the army in World War II, James Heller's book. Anyway, so anyway, what did I do? I was meditating and reading, and I would get up before reveille, and reveille would blow at 6, but I would get up about 5 and go meditate in the chapel. So, all right, so that, and then the ashram and everything. But once Esalen started, and I had been a virgin, I was a virgin until I was 32 years old. All right, so with Esalen, you could say on that front, I melted down, and it was, a delayed adolescence. Certainly, it was whatever. So I, to make a simple way to say it, from being a jnana yogi, which in India is the way of meditation, and with the broad family of meditation practices, not only emptying the mind, but opening to that light that the lady saw Van Gogh. That there's a several basic primal movements of transformative yoga, transformative practice. I was full time until Esalen started. Then it shifted, and what I told myself that I was becoming a karma yogi through works. And I have looked for ways, let's say, when I wrote Golf in the Kingdom, it was truly channeled in many ways. It's amazing. When I look back, our family favored writing my grandmother. Oh my God, she rewarded the writers. My brother had a great success with a novel, and my grandfather delivered John Steinbeck. And so Steinbeck and my father were buddies growing up together.
Wow.
East of Eden, you know, there's a Dr. Murphy. And so, okay. And then Steinbeck became my brother's same agent, same. So, okay. So that was much in the air. All right. Now I was 39 when I sat down to write. My brother had already written a best-selling novel when he was 23. Okay. So,
good Lord.
So how to turn an activity that becomes your primary focus into a kind of channeling.
Yeah.
Now, basically, I had made that move as I started Esalen. And I started to keep a journal of coincidences or synchronicities. Now, Jung had quite an idea there, that synchronicity. There's something to it.
Yeah.
Okay. How to, so that became more and more my yoga. Now, I continued to meditate. I do not meditate now in that way I did then, where I sit down and focus for an hour at a time. I don't do that anymore. But I recollect, I would say, every single hour of the day. But that when it has morphed into a kind of recollection, I can do it right now. And so it's become second nature.
Interesting.
Recollect. Somebody who was actually good at this was Gurdjieff and Uspensky.
Yes.
The older I get, the more I appreciate those guys. At first, I thought, oh, God, that's too much, because there are all these Gurdjieff groups, and some of them are real cults. But nevertheless, it was the mysticism of everyday life, the Gurdjieff and Uspensky. Okay. That recollection, that natural morphing of formal meditation into mindfulness. Now that word has gone abroad in the culture. It's now often misused. I mean, it's been made so extraordinarily vanilla that it's almost washed out all its meaning. But it's right too. The morphability of these profound practices. I mean, you could, right now, it's become a conversation item with my friends explaining who and what is Taylor Swift. What is this phenomenon? I had actually never heard of her until six. So I had no idea that she'd been known for 14 years, and since she was 16 or whatever. And so anyway, it's become and it's very much like my apprehension of the golf world. What goes on? And then the morphing of, let's say, what happens when she fills these stadiums. It's interesting. And then how it takes projections. The New York Times last Sunday had a big thing that she is queer-coded. She's telling the world she's queer.
Oh.
This is, in one way, it's an outrageous critique, but it raises the issue. How come, and you know, in the early days when she the eras to her, these are the eras of her life.
Mm-hmm.
The Swifties have come along with her.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's another example of how humans channel this greater life.
Mm.
And anyway, Dave Morin, who is quite, I call him Gandalf. He's the chairman of our board of Esalen. He's 43, had this huge success in the Valley and still does. And he and his wife, she also is very successful and extraordinary lady. They love Taylor Swift, but he sees in her something a lot different and how people project into her. And so the author more or less confessed at the end. There's a big spread in the New York Times opinion section of the South Sunday. At one level, absolutely outrageous, because, you know, seeing yourself in someone and saying that what she's really doing is trying to tell the world that she's queer. Well, I find that extremely hard to believe. I just do. But what's more interesting is how she is living a life out ahead of her game plan. Because she's obviously, and aided probably by her father, who's a Merrill Lynch broker, she's good in business. She seems to be good at everything. She's just 34 now. She writes these songs, and you watch her. Okay, now I have to say, I've developed an eye for somebody who, let's, lack of a better word, channeling, being possessed by whatever it is that's working. And you can give it a Jungian names, like, you know, you're owning an archetype, or you can, there are many ways contemporary people are trying to name this emergence of this greater life. Goes on in these gatherings, and that where they have the bracelets, who had this idea, and they signaling one another. So you have 70,000 people recently here in down near us here on the peninsula. It's in our poor, impoverished public culture of America, with all its divisions and all its craziness and all that's wrong, finds ways to live into what these great moments in history. I can imagine, let's say, in the Greeks, so Sophocles, what Aristotle's catharsis. I mean, it's what was going on there. Okay, we got ahead of our understanding.
Yes, yes.
Guys on the golf course want to tell me these stories. They've never read William James. They've never ever studied yoga. They've never, nothing. And they're having these authentic experiences. So with her, now, so, okay. Now, see, I digressed here.
Well, but I was thinking it's about you too. I mean, you're talking about how you end up channeling it and embodying it yourself.
All right, well, see, that's it. That's, I would say, at the heart of what I'm doing now is asking how best to serve. Now, in relation to Esalen, and then, okay, so this yoga for me now, I have to say it, and I say this around down there, who's writing the script for this place? This place, this demographic is out ahead, because we do a lot of, well, the staff there, thinking a lot about how to program, who to invite, who not to invite. And so the group, and this is under a new regime over the last couple of years with a new CEO who's doing extremely well. I want to stand back and then channel it through them. So this is me going from a meditator, although I meditate, I still do. And this recollection is a constant in my life.
Yeah.
It's as common to me as breathing.
Yeah.
But so it's alive. And I've tried all sorts of sports stuff and everything. And so now it's very simplified. And so here's now this is getting real confessional here, but all right. So this group we started, Integral Transformative Practice, George Leonard was really the primary architect and invented a kata. You know, that's a series of exercises in the martial arts or, you know, Chinese yoga, a series of, and you've seen them practicing these different movements and kata. So I don't do the kata, but making my bed, I make into a kata. So all these different movements, if you do it thoughtfully and enjoy it. It only takes 4 minutes. It's a complicated bed. So anyway, 4 minutes, but all right, if you do it mindfully with your attention, letting the pleasure of it, letting it morph from work to work. Now, how many people in the kitchen, how many women who are having to do most of the cooking get into this? And I used my mother, her side of the family, which are Basque, French Basque from the Pyrenees. They cooked lights out, just unbelievable. And how did she do it? And all of this, that was for her a yoga.
Yeah.
And little town where we lived, Salinas, the other women would love to get her recipes. And then they'd try and they couldn't bring out the effects she could bring out. And that's when I learned about a craft transcends recipes.
Yes, very much so. It's so, like it seems like you're saying you're channeling it in a way that it just becomes alive within you, that it just becomes it's your life. It's not a practice that's separate. You are it.
Right, exactly. And so if you map me through the day, I'm not the formal looking yogi like I was in my 20s. Wow, I'd have to say I get wonderstruck to different degrees, you know, little ones. Let's say, well, if you give me a whenever, then I can think of all sorts of moments where
whenever,
okay, a dramatic one where I was it overcame me physically was. I was sitting at the back of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, and I had walked in not knowing that they were going to have an extremely high mass led by a cardinal of the church. So I got my way in there, and behind me was the big organ at the back, and then there's the organ up front, so they could play these. I'm dying to get to the new. They've redone the cathedral there at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And so I sat down, and out of the darkness, 100 and some feet up in the darkness, slowly was coming down the red hat of a cardinal on some sort of little cable being lowered while the cathedral fell into silence. And then the organs hit it big. And I started to shake where I couldn't control, I mean, my knees and everything. And then this procession, I think there were 10 bishops and about 20 ministers, and then it came through, but it was below me. So I was looking down and the front, and for an hour, I couldn't stop shaking. My knees were shaking. I mean, it was just, that was an assault that was cellular all the way down, but you know, meditator, I could hold it. And then and in those moments, I've had to learn that you have to grow in capacity to hold these very powerful disclosures.
Yes.
The reason I think a lot of these golfers do it is they work into it so gently, and you're surrounded in the world's largest gardens, these 200 acre gorgeous golf courses, the beautiful ones. Well, there in that cathedral, so that would be to close my eyes, I could get into the realm of my very deepest knowing. No, and this is not believing.
Yes.
This is knowing and seeing and being in some of the higher reaches of the divine nature that are in us all.
That's a great last line. I like that.
Well, listen, wonderful to be with you, really.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Mike Murphy. Thank you so much, Mike. To learn more about Mike's work, check out www.esalen.org. Please come back next time on Wonderstruck. I'll be talking with Nicole Baden Tatsuru Roshi about her life in Zen. For more information about Wonderstruck, our guests, and our events, check out wonderstruck.org. And please follow the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and subscribe on YouTube. We really want to hear from you with your feedback, reviews, and ratings. You can also follow us on Instagram, X, TikTok, and Facebook at WonderstruckPod. Wonderstruck is produced by Wonderstruck Productions, along with the teams at Bailey Newman and Freetime Media. Special thanks to Brian O'Kelly, Eliana Eleftheru, and Travis Reese.
Thank you for listening. And remember, be open to the wonder in your own life.